All right. You ready?
Yes, I am. Okay, so this whole saga began.
Did I not say that I was running this interview?
I'm sorry.
Okay, so can you tell us what happened this weekend?
The short answer? An army of right-wing commentators and online trolls came for me. For me, it started Saturday night when news was just rolling in. When journalist, I will say journalist with a soft J, Andy Ngo, reportedly got beaten really badly. He had to get hospitalized. He went to the ER because he sustained some serious injuries. That is no laughing matter. I'm serious. Nobody should get hurt for doing their job. So I had something to say. I'm familiar with this guy's work. A lot of it is centered around demonizing Muslims, particularly. And for me as a Muslim who reads his work, I see his work as having a lot of consequence that many of these types of writers don't recognize. So what I wrote was, and I'll read it verbatim, I'd argue that the fear-mongering he's done against Muslims, plus the work he's done to discredit hate crimes, helped create an atmosphere of violence that vulnerable people all have to live through just for being who they are. This is bad, but he's guilty of worse.
And then what happened after that?
Michelle Malkin, a conservative with like 2 million followers, quoted me and said that I'd argued that the journalist deserved it. After that, the response came immediately. Refreshing my Twitter notifications was like pulling the lever on a slot machine where the only prizes were racist, threatening, and instigating tweets. Hundreds of commentators avalanched in. Many, like Malkin, accused me of trying to justify the violence. And whenever I thought it was slowing down, another right-wing Twitter account with hundreds of thousands of followers sent a new wave of their angry fans for me. Slate writer suggests Andy Ngo had it
defending
coming.
Actual violent attack against journalists.
Leftists want to murder
protect
you.
Protect yourself by purchasing gun and ammunition.
So it's just been overwhelming, to say the least. All these verified accounts trying to mischaracterize what I was trying to say. And that's not funny. That's not a joke. There's nothing funny about that. I mean, there's nothing funny about telling your followers to buy guns and ammunition to defend themselves from me, right? So I spent that morning slumped on my couch, refreshing, responding. I wasn't above the fray. I called people names right back. Then one person said they wanted my address. You can imagine what for. So I sent my location in a public tweet, like, let them come, whatever. And at that point, my producer on this podcast said that we needed to talk. I'm Ayman Ismail, and you're listening to Man Up. On this show, every week, we tell honest stories about our lives and investigate where we get our ideas about what it means to be a man. So, yeah, my producer Danielle was not impressed with my macho act on Twitter, especially as threats of violence were rolling in. And I didn't really get it right away, so she sat me down in the studio this week.
Hello, listener. Dahlia Lithwick here, host of Amicus, that's Slate's podcast on the courts and the law and democracy and the rule of law. This May, our team will be publishing a special project that we are calling How Originalism Ate the Law. This neutral and academic-sounding methodology of looking at the law is, in fact, anything but neutral. Originalism is to the conservative legal movement what peanut butter is to jelly. As we're going to show you over the course of this project, originalism has been both cover and calling for conservative justices and judges to radically overhaul the lives of millions of Americans. And while they claim to be the apolitical interpreters of the Constitution and its authors' intents, they have overturned Roe, radically expanded gun rights, and eviscerated voting rights. Across Slate.com and the Amicus podcast, we're going to be tackling questions like, where did originalism come from? Why has it taken over? Are progressive originalists really a thing? And am I allowed to have an opinion on originalism? Spoiler, the answer to that last question, you are. To celebrate the launch of this big project, we are running a special 2-week-long free trial of Slate Plus on Apple Podcasts. As a member, you'll get exclusive episodes from How Originalism Ate the Law, plus ad-free listening to all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Join now by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen.
So I want to take a second and tell you guys about this podcast that I've been obsessed with. It's called Ethnically Ambiguous. It's a podcast about the immigrant minority experience, but it's really fun. It's hosted by Iranian-American Anna and Syrian-American Shireen. They discuss growing up with immigrant parents, and they also tell stories from history to help make sense of the news coming out of the Middle East today. And hate to shamelessly self-promote, but I'm the guest on the next podcast. We talked about what it was like to discover our sexualities within our immigrant communities, what it was like to be raised as an outsider, dealing with stereotypes, and about representation in television and film. It comes out every Monday and Wednesday, and it's produced by iHeartRadio and How Stuff Works. And if you're interested in these types of podcasts, then you gotta support them. Listen and subscribe at Apple Podcasts or on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
So I can hear in your voice you're really definitely frustrated with the people you were fighting with on Twitter, but you also shared your address when you were arguing with them. And I want to know what that's about. Like, do you often get into flame wars and, you know,
it's a problem that I have
personal information?
It was my instinct. This person's online being like, hey, give me your address. We'll meet up and we'll fight. My instinct is to be like, okay, yeah, come meet me. Come see what happens. You know, that's kind of like my gut reaction.
Does it feel like a hit on your pride when you don't respond, or if you don't think you should respond, or if you're unable to respond? Does it feel like a little emasculating?
Yeah. I think a part of my body is telling me, yo, Eamon, your manhood is at stake here. And I don't agree with that, but that's what it feels like. It almost feels like if I don't respond, then they are getting the best of me. It almost feels like if I don't say anything, they've won.
So you talk a lot about being a protector and provider for your family.
Yes.
Do you think revealing your address, a place near your address, is in conflict with that idea? Do you think,
I don't think it
comes from a similar place? Like, these people are dangerous. Like people get swatted and die. Like, people get shot by the police for no reason.
Yeah.
Because they get swatted.
And even if it's not, like, on my blog, it could be close enough where they see me walking past and follow me home or follow my wife home. Because, yeah, I understand. It's not smart. And when you put it in that context, it seems very, very stupid and unnecessary.
But I'm trying to understand what context you're coming from where you thought that was the way to go.
Twitter, it doesn't seem public, but in a lot of ways it is, right? It's both this personal journal that you're writing, but it's there for everyone to see. So I think that plays a huge factor in how I'm going to react. I think people are going to perceive my weakness if I don't respond or if I allow this random person to act tough with me and I don't act tough back. So I think a lot of it comes from just that stupid playground mentality where boys are just testing boys. You know, you're like playing basketball or soccer and there's a hard foul and the person gets up off the ground and gets in your face. And then you have two options, right? You can either say, I'm sorry, and walk away. And then the person ridicules you for the rest of the match. And then other people ridicule you and also taunt you. Or you step right up to the plate and you show them you're not going to react so kindly if they try and get in your personal space and threaten you. So I almost felt like that tweet, even though it's on Twitter and it's nothing and it's nobody, it's stupid, but I feel like maybe I felt a little threatened. Maybe I felt like if I didn't respond appropriately in the same way that I had to respond as a kid, that this would escalate. But then I'm saying it and I don't believe it. Like, I don't think that if I hadn't responded that this would have mattered, or we would even be talking about it. It's stupid. I think it's just that instinct still exists, and that physically my body is telling me respond this way, you know?
Yeah. How old are you?
I know.
How old are you?
I'm 29. Just the way you said it, you sound like
When was the last time you were on a playground?
A long time. A very long time. Yeah.
Okay. Just wondering.
I know. It's relevant. It's stupid. And it's not worth the risk. That being said, I did get a little bit of satisfaction from calling this guy's bluff. I did like that, you know? So I didn't just stop there. I didn't just give him a location near where I live so he can meet me in case he wants to fight. I also tweeted a picture of himself back to him and laughed at the idea that someone who looked like that would be caught around my neighborhood. Like, that also to me is really funny. And then I screenshotted it and sent it to my friends who also live in the neighborhood, and we all had a nice little laugh. So,
I mean, okay, you keep saying that you need to get past it and you need to...
I know.
It's embarrassing, but then you say, but, and fall right back. So how are you actively trying to get past that and work on that and change from those actions?
It's... My mind has already been made, right? I've decided that that's not the person that I want to be. That I've gotten past that first step. I can't afford to be that person anymore. There's too much at risk. That being said, my body wants to. My body knows what it knows, and it learned that from its experience on the playground.
Does it feel like you've won once you've responded, or does that feeling last of winning?
Sometimes.
Once you've responded?
Sometimes. Like, for example, when I'll screenshot it and send it to my friends in the group chat and we all laugh, that feels good. That feels like a W, you know? Even if that person doesn't respond afterwards or adds like another qualifier, I still feel as though he tried and he failed, and that feels good. Even though I have no way of knowing that that's what happened.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
So do you often get into arguments like this on Twitter? I see as of 33 minutes ago, you've still responded to the thread.
Yeah, I was arguing with a grandma.
So, yeah, does this happen a lot for you on Twitter?
Yeah, it's kind of an epidemic. It's kind of a problem in my life. I don't know. I feel like, especially on the internet, when you're on Twitter, when you're on Facebook, there's this anonymous factor that's at play. I think people feel more comfortable being aggressive if they have a computer to hide behind or a phone screen to tweet from. And so what ends up happening is people get way more confrontational. As a consequence of that, I feel maybe I'm kind of experiencing the same thing. I'm also on my phone tweeting out that I'm ready to fight too, which is not good, which is not healthy. And so this kind of happens a lot. I've had beef on every social media platform you can imagine. I had LinkedIn beef. You ever have LinkedIn beef? When someone messages you and says, "Hey, I saw your videos. That ain't shit. Blah blah blah." And then I'm like, "Oh, I went through your resume. You worked where? That's lame." And we just went back and forth for no reason.
I didn't know
reason.
It went down in LinkedIn like that.
It goes down in LinkedIn. Seriously.
I mean, the show's been going on for over a month now. Have you gotten any tips on how to handle that from what we've been doing?
Or yeah, just, yeah.
You know, has it made you think in a different way?
Yes. I did an episode where I interviewed Professor Simranjeet Singh, who is a Sikh man who practices the Sikh religion. He wears a turban. So when he gets harassed, it's usually because people are confusing him for a Muslim. They don't even... So we talked about this because I explained to him, I don't know how to respond correctly. I feel like there's no way to win. There's no correct way to respond to bullying. And he told me something interesting. He talked about how in his religion, it preaches patience and optimism. So that taught him to, instead of trying to bully his bullies back, he's actually trying to reason with them. He wants to talk to them and explain to them how what they did is messed up. And he's actually had some success. So I want to try that. And I wonder how this would have been different if I told him, I don't want to fight you. Actually, I want to talk to you. Why do you feel like you want to fight me? Why do you want to know where I live?
So on the episode with Simran that you mentioned, where you told the story of being harassed in the street, did you feel out of control in that situation? And do you feel like responding on Twitter feels like a situation where you can control something?
Yeah, I'm really happy you brought that up, because it feels like that situation and the kinds of messages that I'll get on Twitter are very paralleled, right? They use the same language. So on the street, this guy, I mean, there was no way I could mute or block this guy, right? He's standing in my face. He makes his hand into a gun with his like pointer finger and thumb and presses it up against my head and says, if any of your cousins back home try and blow up this country, I'm going to blow your brains out, right? Like, that's something that happened in real life that I can't just tune out. But the difference is I didn't know how to respond, right? I was kind of just standing there thinking to myself, like, what is going on? This is happening. Like, this is New York City, broad daylight. Like, I don't know any other world. Like, I was born and raised, like, 3 miles away. So, like, I don't understand. Like, I feel like I let myself down by not responding, by not having some kind of comeback. In like the heat of it, right? Or at least getting it on camera. Like, I mean, that was like another thought that I had. I was like, wow, this happened and I just have to live with it. Like, that's it. And I like said something, but it was weak. I was like, just get out of my face. And then his drunk friend came and they were both like whisked away into the city. And I was left feeling like a victim. I was just standing there feeling stupid. Like, I should have done something. I should have done more to prevent this from happening. And that I felt like if only, I was like running through all the scenarios in my head, if only I had said this.
So when you're replying to these people, does it make you feel a sense of control that maybe you haven't had in certain situations in your life?
I mean, I want to say yes.
Like, have you convinced yourself that you'll like have the perfect comeback on the internet because you have time and you have editing and you basically have all the time in the world to respond and be like and come back with like the perfect crack, you know?
Yeah, and I wish I can do that in person when it happens in real life, but I think the difference is online I can take that second to first react. I can read it, digest it, and then draft the perfect response. And then once I'm comfortable with the response, I can hit send, which is something I wish I can do in the moment when I'm confronting Islamophobia or racism in real life. So it's different in that way, where I can act like I have the reins, act like I'm in control of the situation, of the interaction.
Can you say more about why you feel that way?
Yeah, I mean, it's really awesome when someone comes at you, it's like trying to be racist, and then you're able to respond and kind of feel like you have a witty comeback. And whether or not they feel owned or not, you kind of still walk away feeling like you own them. So, for example, right, and this is a real message that I get all the time. If someone were to message me and say, oh, well, you must hate this person because you have a Muslim mind, and a Muslim mind thinks in this way. And if I respond to them with a stupid GIF that shows like a brain pulsating or anything where I kind of like take the wind out of their sails. That makes me feel, when I walk away from that, like that I put on display basically for whoever else is going to see it, how this person failed. They were trying to get under my skin. They were trying to get me to feel something that I didn't let them know that I felt.
So what are those, I guess, what are those feelings that you're trying to combat?
Yeah, I mean, it's a spectrum, right? So it starts usually with anger. It starts with disgust. And then it starts to go inward. Then it spreads. And then it makes me feel humiliated. It makes me feel like I wasn't man enough. It makes me feel smaller. And then it becomes a vehicle for sadness and depression. And it makes me feel like if I'm allowing this to happen, or it makes me feel like when I'm on the other end of these kinds of bigoted attacks, then who am I if I can't defend that? And this isn't just starting with the internet. This is starting with just me being a brown kid in America, you know? And not just by bullies, by police officers and judges who also don't see the humanity in you. And so when I'm confronting it on the internet, all those feelings come back, and I'm confronting all of those cops and judges and teachers and crossing guards even all over again. And so all of the ways that I wish I can respond to those people IRL, I end up responding to the internet trolls, except it doesn't work. And that's the hardest part about it, is knowing that even for a split second, if it feels good, I end up shooting myself in the foot. I end up allowing them to continue to broadcast me as a target. And then it turns into a pile on real quick. And so, yeah, I don't know. I just wish that I didn't have to, but at the same time, just for being who I am, it feels unavoidable. And if I don't respond, it doesn't go away.
Yeah, so I guess where you're coming from is that you kind of feel trapped and there's no real answer to this. And so there's no way that you can have it be a good outcome from a situation like this. But like, I think we can both agree that like handing out your location on the internet.
Yeah.
Definitely a no. That's
a bad idea.
Off the list of options.
Never doing that again.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm glad we've established that.
I don't want to lose sight of how this all started. Protesters brutally assaulted a journalist in the street, and that's inexcusable. The video is hard to watch. I didn't choose my words carefully, and opportunistic people on the right saw a chance to dunk on a Slate writer. A lot of people were misled to believe that I was endorsing that violence, which I never would. And so when the responses rolled in, and I felt unjustly pushed around, I pushed back. I saw it as standing up for myself, but I think it was more of a basic impulse, a sort of adolescent need to join the fight. And because so many of the responses were racist, I had a hard time walking away, giving bigots the last word. But because I did get a little bit of satisfaction, I'm not so sure that it was all for nothing. Jumping into the void, trying to get a few snarky jabs in, felt like one way of standing up against bigotry, even if it's not exactly pretty. To be honest, I'm not exactly sure if there's any good way to respond. Even not responding can leave me feeling down. So what should I do here? Maybe I should just start by deleting Twitter from my phone. Just don't at me. So that's the show. Here at Man Up, we love getting emails and voicemails, and we'd love to hear from you too. Got thoughts about this week's episode, or maybe have ideas on what to talk about next? Leave a message at 805-626-8707. That's 805-MAN-UP-07. Or just leave us a voicemail at manup@slate.com. If you liked this episode, consider supporting The Kid and leaving a review in Apple Podcasts or wherever you like to listen. Not only do we appreciate it, but it helps other people find the show too. Man Up is hosted and written by me, Ayman Ismail. Our producers are Danielle Hewitt and Cameron Drews. Our executive producers are Jeffrey Bloomer and Lohan Liu. Gabriel Roth is the editorial director of Slate Podcasts. June Thomas is the senior managing producer. And TJ Raphael is the senior producer of Slate Podcasts.